Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
As I mentioned on Friday, stories, anecdotes, more important right now than ever before. Interesting people telling interesting stories is critical right now. As an example, Jimmy Johnson talking about Barry Switzer taking a dump in a shoe.
You'd have a big dump in your poop.
In your shoe. Oh, wait, do that again, Alvin.
You'd have a big dump in your boot.
Perfect. He told a story about Barry Switzer taking a big dump in a boot.
You'd have a big dump in your boot.
And when everybody there realized what it was, they all threw up. This is the kind of content we all need right now. Now, it's a given. If Jimmy Johnson is telling the story, it's going to be an awesome story. If Jimmy Johnson is telling a story about Barry Switzer, then it's going to be a legendary story. That's a lock. We know this. This is a given. Now, here's something I did not see coming. I saw that coming from a mile away. Here's something I did not see coming. Here's a storyteller that I did not see coming. Carmelo Anthony. You see, he and Dwayne Wade did an Instagram live session. And Melo had stories. Melo had stories for days about how he thinks, for instance, how different his life might be had he been drafted by the Pistons. He said that. He talked about how different his life would be if he had been drafted by the Pistons. Let me translate that for you. He'd have a ring. He'd have a ring, and then the entire universe would see him in a different light. Let me translate that for you, too. They'd see him in a different light. And not as a me first, no defense playing ball hog. But like I said, he is the storyteller that I did not see coming. And he had a pair of amazing stories about Kobe and about LeBron. Let me start with Kobe and Melo telling a story about an early meeting the two of them had.
I come on the court, so you know you come on the court. That's why it's like it's hard to speak to people when they come on the court, because you don't know what their mentality is. They might dub you, right? They might not even say nothing to you. They might not shake your hand. So,
right.
Kobe comes on the court, gives me dab. I give him dab. So throughout the game, he's like saying little shit to me, like, "Oh yeah, now we gonna let you go off right now until the fourth quarter. I'm gonna guard you in the fourth quarter." And I'm like, "Get the what? Get out of here. You gonna guard me? Why you don't guard me now?" He's like, "Nah. I'm not here to stop you. We here to stop you." So when you young and hear that, you be like, "Oh, like what is it? What is he talking about? I'm about to get buckets." So the game went on, the game goes on, and fourth quarter comes. I mean, he's getting every call. He's fouling. He's not calling shit. And he's just like, "I told you. I told you what's about to happen." And I'm like, what's happening? He's like, "All right, let's go. Let's give the world what they want to see." Offensive rebound, he fouling me, grabbing me. He come down, I foul him hard. I come back down, he foul me hard. We talking trash.
Let me pause right there. Because that's great. That's the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. That's the behind-the-kind-of-curtain stuff we need now more than ever. Let us in. I love that Melo is sharing this kind of content. But the trash-talking and the jawing is about to get to another level. Now it's about to be about Melo's hair. Roll it.
I have my braids then. The most disrespectful shit anybody can do is touch your braids. Like, if somebody got a tech, I don't know if it was me or somebody, like, got a tech, and we at half court, and he like hit the bottom of my braids, like
on purpose, like just smack.
Like, yeah, just like calm down, little bro, like that, like. He little bro me, like he sunned me right there. I'm just like, "I'm gonna kill this, like, you don't touch my braids." So then from that point on, it was just like after the game, he came to me, he was just like, "You got my respect." And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, what, we gotta play for your respect? Like, at this time I don't know. Like, I gotta play for your respect? No, I'm trying to come out here and go and tear you apart.
Right.
And he's like, "Nah, like, you know, you didn't back down. Like, you went hard. Like, I'm even hurting right now. Like, yo, my chest hurt, my body hurt. Boom. Like, I wasn't, you know, I wanted to see if you was going to stand the test of time."
You know how I always say, we don't really know any of these guys? Like, how much more do you like Melo after hearing that story? You knew it was going to be good when Melo said, quote, the most disrespectful bleep anybody can do is touch your braids. Braids. When he said that, you knew exactly what Kobe was about to do. And then he did it. And it was intentional. And it was perfect. Obviously, he was measuring him. He was testing him. I'm not sure what I like better. Kobe telling Melo how it was going to be in the first three quarters and then the fourth quarter. Or Kobe intentionally punking Melo by flicking his braids. The most disrespectful bleep that you could do. Because he knew it would mess with him. And it did. And yet somehow from all of that, Kobe talking all that junk and doing the most disrespectful bleep that you could ever do, emerged a friendship, emerged a respect. That was actually the start of their friendship, which is amazing. Now, if Melo had only told that story, that would have been worth the price of admission. But he had more, and it was just as good. As an example, what if I told you that LeBron James once saved the life of Carmelo Anthony? And I don't mean figuratively, not in a metaphorical sense. This is not a matter of Bron reaching out to Melo when Melo was out of the league and picking him up. Not his metaphorical life, his actual life. According to Carmelo Anthony, LeBron James actually, literally saved Carmelo Anthony's life. It's about that time when the banana boat crew went snorkeling and things didn't go that well for Melo. In fact, not well at all. Check this story.
Barracuda snorkeling and all that, so... It was my fault that I look up. The current is taking me in the middle of the ocean, like opposite from the boat.
We couldn't see you.
I know. And it was windy. It was all type of shit was going on through my head. I'm going to be honest with you. Then I look up at the boat and I see Bron jumps off the boat like he is, like he's MacGyver.
No, like that commercial that he had, the LeBrons, like
yes, exactly. He jumped off the boat into the water. He was bringing me back with one arm. He's swimming with the other arm, and he carrying me in one arm.
I told people this story before. I said, listen, I've seen LeBron do a lot of amazing things on the court.
That was special.
On the court, when he went and saved Melo,
he saved my life. I can't hold you. He saved my life. Yo, Bron, I appreciate that. You saved my life that day.
Yeah, shout out.
Them little flippers wasn't working for me.
Okay, first of all, I think you're confusing MacGyver with Hasselhoff. But still, that's one hell of an image. A future Hall of Famer just drifting out to sea. Another legend jumping into the water like MacGyver to save him. LeBron is dragging Melo with one arm and swimming with the other. Never mind coming back from down 3-1 to Golden State or scoring 25 straight in a conference finals game. That might be the most impressive thing that Bron's ever done. Remember, Melo is listed at 6'8", 238. I'm guessing that on vacation, there's a chance that Melo might have been a little heavier than his fighting weight. And he's in the water, so he's kind of dead weight. And LeBron is just dragging this guy through the current. Melo himself couldn't swim through the current, but LeBron is going to swim through that same current with Melo. I mean, that's insanity. Never mind also that Dwayne Wade said we couldn't see him. Apparently LeBron did. LeBron's like, I got this. Like, I can remember as a kid going to Malibu, and I got caught in this rip current, and I'm just swimming and swimming and swimming and getting nowhere. I thought I was dead. You know, and some lifeguard who had a pair of binocs comes out and gets me. But I was like 9 and probably weighed 65 pounds. This is Carmelo Anthony, 6'8", 238. And if they list him at 238, hell, knowing Melo, he was probably 278 at that point. And LeBron's just swimming this guy to safety. LeBron James saving Carmelo Anthony's life and Melo completely owning up to it and capping off that story with, quote, yo, Bron, I appreciate that. You saved my life that day. Them little flippers wasn't working for me, end quote. Them little flippers wasn't working for me is a great description. And it would have been a horrible way for it to end for Melo. None of us have really any say in how it goes or how it ends, but that's not the way you want to go. With those little flippers not working for you, them little flippers. I got to be real. Melo has been an utter revelation, at least as a storyteller. I mean, I guess we probably should have known that he would be, because as I mentioned, we don't really know any of these guys. He just doesn't always let that side of himself show. But when he gets with Duane, the stories start flowing. I need this. I need this on a daily basis, Melo. Just one story a day. One story a day. You don't have to empty your notebook. Just one story a day. That's all we're asking. Hit us with guys talking trash, you talking trash back, you nearly buying it because them little flippers weren't working. Anything that's on your mind, let it rip because it is gold. Fire up Instagram Live, keep feeding us, or Facebook Live, whatever you want, especially now that we're hungry. Keep feeding us. And I'm telling you, there's a residual benefit here, Melo. You do that consistently enough. You do that long enough, and pretty soon, everybody will love you and forget that you've never won a ring, that you never played defense, you never shared the ball, and you always put yourself ahead of your team as an NBA player. And don't come in here, don't at me and come in here with all those gold medals that he won. Oh, and while we're here, can we all admit that winning a ring with a third different franchise may not guarantee LeBron GOAT status? Again, as long as we're here, can we all just acknowledge this? Winning a ring with a third franchise may not guarantee LeBron GOAT status, but winning a ring with a third franchise and swimming Melo to safety and saving his life, the two of those things together certainly would guarantee GOAT status.
Them little flippers wasn't working for me.
Man, my respect for both of them just went up. I didn't know that it can go much higher for LeBron. I knew it could go higher for Melo, but it just went up for both.
The most disrespectful shit anybody can do is touch your braids. Like.
Kobe. What a great story about Kobe. He is John Morosi. John, normally you'd be coming on this show at this time and we would be talking about the first few days of the MLB season, the last few days of the NHL regular season. Of course, everything is different right now. So how are you, John, and how is life treating you?
Well, Jim, thanks for having me on the show today and for the conversation. And certainly, first and foremost, thanks for keeping the conversation going around sports for all of us in the country to keep us all connected. So keep doing the great job that you're always doing. We're doing well here in Michigan. I would say, first and foremost, my wife is a doctor herself at a couple of the hospitals here in Michigan. So she is quite busy and really I'm so proud of the work that she's doing and all of her colleagues that are involved in the medical field. So first and foremost, supporting her, and then also at home, we've got three daughters. So I've been doing a lot of teaching as well, and hopefully having some good lesson plans there. But really, the big focus is, I think for all of us, we're all citizens first right now. And so in my case, a citizen first, and then, of course, a husband to my wife to help her do the great work that she's doing right now.
John Morosi. At home, homeschooling. I think you might be the greatest homeschool teacher ever. I want to thank your wife, John, and everybody on the front line for doing what they're doing. And as I mentioned last week, also everybody else who is making things better and easier for us, people who work at grocery stores, people who are providing services, people who are putting themselves out there at great risk so we can all keep going. I want to thank them once again, too. So, John, there's news that I want to get to, but before I do so, I want you to tell a few stories, if you don't mind. You've been with the MLB Network now for 8 years, and you've been on Twitter talking about some of your favorite memories from each year. I want to hit you with a couple so you can expand upon them. You have more than 140 or 280 characters. How about that time when Madison Baumgartner came out of the bullpen in Game 7 at Kauffman Stadium in KC? What do you remember about that moment?
Well, first of all, thanks for following the Twitter account there with some of the memories that I've been sharing. That World Series 2014 was magnificent for so many reasons. And we knew entering that Game 7 that it was going to be managed aggressively by both sides. Tim Hudson starting for the Giants in what became the final game of his career, and then Jeremy Guthrie for the Royals. We knew that certainly both managers would go to their bullpen early. And with Bumgarner, we had a sense that he was going to come into the game at some point. What we didn't know was how early and for how long. And so when Bochy goes to him in the fifth inning, I just remember that gasp, that oh my goodness reaction rippling down press row in the press box there at Kauffman Stadium, saying, oh my gosh, he's going to him so early. And the thought was that maybe he'd be able to go in there for 2-3 innings at the most. It was the belief that he'd be, maybe be able to do that, but certainly not 5. And that was just, it was almost impossible to conceive of an outing like that on such little rest after he'd been so dominant in Game 5 in San Francisco with just then 2 days to rest. So I would say it was one of the best individual performances I've ever seen. Also, remember, he was a little wobbly in that first relief inning that he threw, and then settled in after that and had this magnificent closing, which nearly got away from the Giants in the ninth inning with the single by Alex Gordon that was misplayed into a triple, or the two-base error, rather. And, of course, that eternal question, should Mike Gerschle have sent Gordon? I don't think so in that moment, but certainly it's one of those great debates that we'll have from now until forever.
No doubt. John Morosi is joining us. And then, John, there is that detail from Game 7 of the 2016 World Series between Chicago and Cleveland. You were following the action in the 10th inning from a stairwell behind home plate without the benefit of a TV monitor. Lay it out for me. Why were you in that stairwell, and how could you tell what was going on?
Thanks for asking, Jim. It's a really interesting story because as the Cubs had the lead late, I was covering that game for MLB Network, of course, so we were not the rights holder. The game was on Fox. So the general idea is that if you're part of the group of reporters who are allowed to be on the field after a clinch situation, you line up with about maybe an inning to go before, maybe so you'd line up starting in the eighth inning in a sort of a queue next to the field. And in Progressive Field in Cleveland, that is the umpire's room tunnel right behind home plate. There's a staircase and it goes down into the hallway that leads to like the suite areas, the field level suites there in Cleveland. And so we get there during the eighth inning when, of course, all the mayhem occurs and the game is tied and goes into extra innings. There's a rain delay. So I probably spent a good hour and a half in that tunnel. Some of us had cell phone reception that allowed us to watch the game on our phones on a delay, though. So you were watching that about 30 minutes or 30 seconds late, rather. So I'm down in that tunnel thinking to myself, well, how am I going to see what's happening? And by now there were two outs. The Cubs are one out away from winning. And, of course, there was a run scored in that inning. There was some traffic on the bases. It was not an easy closeout for the Cubs, nor could we have ever expected it to be easy for them. And so as I'm inching forward, I wasn't close to anybody that had a phone out, so I was just looking up. And as I looked up, the only person who I could see sitting on the very edge of that aisle, basically over the tunnel opening, was Theo Epstein. Theo was actually holding his son, as I recall it. And so I said, well, I'm just going to look up and watch Theo, and his reaction is going to tell me if the Cubs have won or if they lost. Mm. And sure enough, with two outs, I'm looking up at Theo, and the ground ball is hit to Bryant, as we learned later, and he throws it to first base, and I think Theo tosses his son in the air in joy and a big smile, and he's congratulating everybody around him, all the Cubs front office people, and that's how I found out the Cubs have won the World Series. With like 15 seconds after that, I was thrust through the little gate and onto the field and rushing up to Dexter Fowler. By the time I got to Dexter, he was already crying. So that rush of emotion when you're thrust into that, Jim, and you don't even really know what happened besides the fact that the Cubs had just won, of course, which that was really the only relevant thing at that point in time, but not even be able to watch the final play of the game that you're then doing interviews about was kind of unique.
Crazy.
And I'll never forget it. And I remember seeing Bill Murray on the field. It was just a surreal series of events there 4 years ago in Cleveland.
That is wild. John Morosi is joining us. All right, so speaking of the Cubs, John and Theo, when you think about the Cubs and where they are, well, where they were as a team and an organization right after they won the World Series and all the talent they had, it felt like it might be the start of a dynasty. What would you have said if I told you they'd lose the NLCS in 5 the next season, get bounced in the wild card game the year after that, and then miss the playoffs altogether in 2019?
I would have been stunned because given the common thread, you look at the teams that have had dynasties or something close to it, Jim, and they're almost always clubs that have young, homegrown, controllable position players, which the Cubs have had. They've had this group of Bryant and Rizzo and Baez and Contreras and Russell at different times. A lot of great young talent, and you would have expected them to be able to sustain that, at least get one more World Series appearance out of it. Certainly going into the NLCS in three consecutive years is a pretty good achievement, but not being able to then build upon it was, to me, a little surprising. I think it also speaks, Jim, to the challenge of baseball, the format of the sport, and how much competitive balance there is. But also, the Cubs, for so long, Jim, that had been their cause, was getting to the World Series and winning it. And once they did it, it changed things a little bit. And I think that they've still spent some time now reformulating what that identity for that organization is going to be into the future. Of course, they had a managerial change after last season, and David Ross, this is where we had so much turnover in the managerial ranks in the game, some of it unexpected when you think about the Mets and the certainly in that case and the Astros and the Red Sox this winter. But certainly you think about the Cubs and David Ross, a very first-time manager, to have spring training interrupted in the way that it has been, and then knowing that you're probably going to have another 3 weeks or so, we hope, once the season gets going again, it does make for a somewhat of a difficult interruption for them, for obviously the entire world and sports world, not to trivialize the baseball part of things, but it's that difficulty in having a continuity of their ethic a little bit, where I think they were interrupted a bit with their with the way they were playing and maybe the culture. Now they have to find a way to restore it at a time when, certainly, as we know, Jim, there are much weightier issues before our nation and the world.
John Morosi is joining us. I think that's a really fascinating point you made about the Cubs, that once they finally did win it after chasing it for so long, there's this change of identity, and now they've got to go about kind of reinventing themselves all over again. And then to the point that you just made, John, when you talk to people around the league, what is your sense as to how teams are handling the delayed start to the regular season?
Well, Jim, that's the question before everybody right now, and I think there's no one easy way to do it. I was just even texting with an executive today who just expressed just how tough this is. First of all, as humans, as citizens, as we're going through it, that's the number one aspect and the concern that we have for our fellow residents and people in our families, and certainly ourselves in many cases as well. There's just a lot of concern right now. So that's obviously first and foremost in supporting those that are in need and those who are caring for them, number one. But then you think about just the baseball routine and the rhythm. We all want our routines back. Whatever our routines are, we want them back in the worst way. That's just the natural human feeling right now. And I think for baseball, Jim, the biggest question is going to be, what does the return to play look like? I think for now you've got pitchers who are effectively in off-season mode. Maybe they're still throwing a little bit, but they're not ready to go by any means. They're going to need to have 3 weeks of a quote-unquote spring training, summer training, if you will, before they can start their season. And then I think we have to realize that, and I think this is really key as a part of the agreement that was struck last week between the union and MLB, the parties realize there is going to have to be some flexibility, that we may well start in June or July with being able to play in all 30 ballparks, but knowing that because of all the unknowns that exist with the novel coronavirus, there could be a hot spot that occurs in a city or more than one city during the course of the summer and late and fall, and that may involve moving games around again or having games with no fans or, you know, neutral site games. And while I think the understanding is, Jim, that when we start, we want to optimally start where it is safe to do so and have crowds all over the place, we realize that may not continually be true during the course of what still could be a 4, 5, 6 month season with potentially neutral site games at the end of it. So I just think in general we are up against a foe that we don't know all the information about. We know that from a public health standpoint, we just simply don't know enough. That's number one. But number two, I am heartened by the fact that there is robust communication and a lot of flexibility in different ways to hopefully get this season in, whatever it takes.
I agree with that. John Morosi joining us for another couple of moments. John, I could hit you on any number of issues, but let me just pick one or two more things before I let you go. You mentioned the notion of a neutral site or neutral sites at the end of the year. Scott Boras, for instance, has been talking about having the World Series or games in the World Series played in a neutral site like the Super Bowl. What do you make of that idea in general?
Well, I think the idea has some merit, Jim, and Scott, to his credit, has come up with this before and have he's advocated for some element, maybe if it's a nine-game World Series. He has been saying this for years, and I think actually it's a really interesting idea, that you would have a best-of-nine World Series, and the first two games would be at a neutral site every single year. That would allow you, like, you think about the NBA All-Star Game, the MLB All-Star Game, the Super Bowl, these big events where you can surround one site that you know well in advance and celebrate a lot of different things about the game in it. I think it's a great concept, and the commissioner has signaled an open-mindedness to changing the playoff format in the past. I think that the circumstances of this year make a different playoff format, I would say the word likely, because we don't know how long the season's going to be. I think some creativity is merited. We could see neutral sites. I would almost be surprised, Jim, if the format of the playoffs in 2020 is the same as the format that it's been the last several years. I think it's going to be a different format, maybe more teams involved, different variances of the number of berths and how many games in each round, because this is the time to be creative and the time to do something different. And I do think we will see this season, Jim, culminating with a neutral site World Series sometime in November and maybe even early December.
John, one last point then. What about that open-mindedness and creativity as it relates to the regular season? Do you think that the league is open to doing new and different things, the types of things you're talking about, to experiment with the regular season, or is the expectation that it's just going to look like it's going to approach it as a shortened version of the regular season?
Great question, Jim. And I think one of the really key parts of it, first and foremost, we could see doubleheaders. That's been broached a little bit. Although I do have some concern that if you have a lot of doubleheaders and they are occurring in a city that it ends up becoming a hotspot, then you have to reschedule nine games in a homestand as opposed to seven. So it makes it a bit more challenging. I also think that we could see, if not the abolishment for 1 year, but a diminishment in the number of interleague games played, because you want to stay in your league to have a truer, fairer competition because there's fewer number of games there. And also travel-wise, I do think that, generally speaking, Jim, I think for all of us Americans right now, there's that instinct to maybe staying closer to home just with all the uncertainty is not a bad option. So maybe you stay and play more games in your division as a percentage, and that makes the scheduling hopefully a little bit easier and the travel logistics a little bit easier as well. So I think all those things have to be on the table. And finally, I'd note this, that the neutral sites that we could see utilized if the health experts, if they decide that smaller crowds are better and that crowds in warmer venues are better because perhaps the virus may not transmit quite as extensively in the warmer climates in the summertime, maybe those neutral sites become the spring training sites, smaller crowds, warmer temperatures, easier logistics once you're already in Florida and Arizona. Perhaps that is one option that MLB can look at to try to get this schedule in and get it moving and get us back to our beautiful routine of watching baseball, Jim, at 7 o'clock every night.
Now, that is a great conversation. He is an MLB Network insider and MLB.com columnist, NHL Network, Fox Sports, great friend of the program. John, I always appreciate our conversations, but never more so than during this time. Thanks for making so much time for us, and great to have you back in the jungle, John.
Jim, thank you so much for everything that you do and for keeping our national conversation going. You're such a leader for what you do in this great show, and just thanks for all you do and keep it going.
Right now, there's another weird idea that we have to deal with, something way more bizarre than having an entire league and all of its teams living under and in the same actual bubble. There's something even more bizarre than that. Yesterday, some random account on Twitter tweeted out the following message. At Tiger Woods, at Phil Mickelson, do you think there's a chance you two could go play a round mic'd up with one camera guy and just put it out there on a stream for people to watch? We need live sports. End quote. Right, this is not original or creative at all. There's probably like a million people who've had the same idea at the same point over the last couple of weeks. Because you try to figure out what sporting event would require the fewest number of people in order to pull off. And then you imagine what it might look like. Match play golf is right up there with the easiest to pull off. So that guy tweets it. You know, not that creative, not that original. Just some rando throwing out an idea into the universe and seeing what might come back. Generally, 1,000 times out of 1,000 times, that goes into a black hole. It never comes back. Yet for some reason, lo and behold, it did. And not only that, it was Phil Mickelson that brought that back. Hefty, took a break from posting selfies of his calves, and he responded. Now, before I get to the response, how weird is it that Hefty was just tweeting a pic of his calf in response to a follower a couple of weeks back? I mean, there have been a lot of weird things lately, but Phil Mickelson tweeting out a pic of his chiseled calf is right near the top of the list. As I always say, weird is good, except not that weird. There's nothing good about that. Anyway, because Hefty's new hobbies appear to be working out in a gym and hanging out on Twitter, of course he saw that tweet from some rando, and he responded, quote, working on it, quote unquote, working on it. And then all at once, Golf Guy started freaking out. Golf Guy ripping his cargo shorts out of the closet, throwing on the soft spikes, fist pumping with tears streaming down his face. These guys were marching around their living rooms, and suddenly they've got a purpose. Suddenly they've forgotten that they're stuck in the house with their wife and their kids with nothing to do. Suddenly they're out there grabbing a mug from the kitchen cabinet, shoving the same kids out of the way, and now they're practicing their putts on the carpet. But let me ask you this. What if this is just Phil being hilarious old Phil? What if it's just him messing around and yanking everybody's chain on Twitter? You know, clowning all you dopes and sheep. Just going through his mentions on a Sunday night and responding to random eggs on Twitter with nonsense and calf porn. Calf pics. So, another account, of course, jumps in and responds, please don't tease. To which Hefty responded, I don't tease. I'm kind of a sure thing. Hey-o! Hilarious. But actually, you know, as my kid says, but actually, does that mean that he and the cat really are working on something? Is something really in the works? And if the answer is yes, then allow me a quick follow-up. Were you there the first time you and the cat tried to shove this epic fail down our throats, Hefty? Because I was. We all were. And far be it from me to stop somebody from trying to put on a sporting event right now. Because I'm in the business of talking sports, and there are no sporting events. Far be it for me to stop somebody from trying to put on a sporting event right now, but no sports might actually be better than the match two. In fact, there's no actually about it. Nothing is way better than the match two, because that really was an unmitigated disaster and the biggest waste of time and money ever. And everybody associated with it, not named Hefty, would tell you that, if they're being honest. Do you remember the extremely lame buildup to that event? And the fact that everybody was being told Tiger and Phil were going to be mic'd up and the gloves were coming off. The two of the game's alleged greatest smack runners ever were going to tear into each other. And finally, we were all going to be let inside the ropes. You know, get the kind of access that you can never get. Get the kind of access that you can only get if you pay for it. Premium access that you can never be afforded on free TV. After all, they got to give you something. If you're going to pay for something that you've seen a million times before, presumably they're going to give you something you've never seen. So you had all this desperate hype leading up to the match and about how these two dudes were going to go in on each other. No holds barred. Just talking crazy bleep and laying crazy bets all over the place. I mean, ordinarily, I'd have no interest, but I got to admit, they had my interest. We were all finally going to see the way it really is. That was the bait. That was the pitch. And then what did we get? None of it. None of that. Even worse, it was as if they knew that they were mic'd up. So they were even more robotic than they are when they're not mic'd up. I mean, who can ever forget when they were spitting this legendary fire at each other?
All right, low score in the hole from here for two. I'm sorry? Low score in a hole from here for two. And given that I'm spotting you 40 yards, what kind of odds are you laying?
No odds. You either take it or you don't.
3-2 odds, I'll take it.
No.
As good as you're swinging? It's intimidating, huh?
It is.
Man, how painful was that? How hard was that to listen to? How awkward was that?
Awkward.
Could you even hear them talking above the mouth breathing? All the mouth breathing and the heavy sniffling. That was the most memorable part of the entire event. The breathing. The heavy, labored breathing. I mean, the fact that you had a sporting event, a pay-per-view event, the thing that everybody was all hyped up on, and the only thing anybody remembers is the breathing. That tells you everything you need to know about that event. And the golf was even worse than the dialogue. That wasn't two legends of the game going at it in their prime. It's a couple of old men breathing really hard and sniffling. Hey, but don't take my word for it. Not in terms of the quality of the golf. What do I know, right? What do you know, Rome? You're right, I don't know Jack. Why don't you find somebody who really knows something about bad golf? Okay, ask Charles Barkley.
Am I allowed to talk?
Yeah, man.
I just want to know something, America. This is some crappy golf. Y'all know that.
Now we're getting somewhere. Charles Barkley. If Charles Barkley, you know I love Chuck, but if Chuck calls it crappy golf.
Crappy golf.
That says something. That says a lot. That tells you all you need to know. It sounds like a punchline, right? Charles Barkley thought that golf sucked.
Crappy golf.
Except he did. He said as much. Yeah, I'm only talking about this because Hefty was teasing it. But let's also forget, Tiger was off from the very beginning. And then as a result of that, he does what he does. He starts to scuffle. He starts to grind. He's chasing the entire time, which means he took whatever personality he might have been able to bring to the event, and he shoved it right back into the bag. But now they're allegedly thinking about running back one of the biggest disappointments ever. Like, for who? For what? Is being a couple of years older going to make that better? Doubt it. I mean, I'm sure Hefty is looking for a way and a place to showcase his calves. But have you seen the way he's played of late? He's missed the cut in four of his last five events. You know, unless dude's going to go out there in his capris and knock it all over the yard and try and get us to look at his calves. I mean, it's all about the golf. He's missed the cut four of the last five times he's been out there. Tiger, meanwhile, finished DFL among golfers who made the cut at RIV this year. Just 22 shots back of Adam Scott, who won the event. And Tiger looked terrible. And now someone's trying to get these two guys, who've been a mess on tour this year, to play a match event. Again, why? Yeah, I know. One of you is going to jump in with, hey, Rome, what do you mean why? Why, Rome? Aren't you always the one who says, why does anybody do anything? Because they can? All right, fair enough. But let me say something else right now. Let me be the one who also always says something else. They can't do this. Why? Because I said so. That's why. I'll give you a better reason. Because it's 2020. It's not 2000. I know people are looking for entertainment right now. We are anxious, but we are not desperate. We're hungry, but we're not dying. These are tough times, but they're not that tough, and we're not that stupid. And believe this, I know for a fact that seeing these two busted up and broken down dudes on a golf course running the weakest smack ever is not going to make anybody feel better. It's not going to make us feel better. It's not going to put a smile on our face. Even if they stream it for free, that wouldn't make it better. And by the way, neither would paying me to see it. That wouldn't make it better either. You're not helping them. You're hurting them, Phil. And you shouldn't be talking about it on Twitter, man.
It's not helping kids. It's hurting them, Rome. And he shouldn't be talking about it on the radio, man.
Stick to what you're best at right now. Stick to what you're best known for right now. Crazy, crazy calf shots. Or maybe I can bring Elk back and he can break it down. And break down exactly what this is. Phil's next phase after the big reveal.
You know, in your neighborhood, mate, when you've got a gal or a woman in the neighborhood that's carrying about extra 40 or 50 and she puts it on the neighborhood app, she says she's going to do a cleanse or she's going to go into yoga. And then you see her like 3 weeks later, she's dropped 20 and she's wearing a thong at the party on the corner barbecue cookout. This is called the big reveal. And this is the phase that we're in with Hefty. This is the reveal, mate. This is normal. There's only one other phase. It's either he comes out to the tour looking like Randy Orton next year, or he goes back to phase one. It goes back to the cleanse. There's no other way. This is just common behavior, mate.
This is common behavior, mate. This is the big reveal, mate. Javon Hargrave is my guest. Javon, nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm good, man. I can't complain.
Good,
happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. Appreciate you. All right, so when you signed with the Eagles, there was a move, or it was a move, that got a lot of attention around the league because of what you've done since you entered the league and what you can do in Philadelphia's scheme. So take me back to the start of free agency. What was it about Philadelphia that made you feel like that was the right spot for you?
I mean, I feel like just Philadelphia just always had a kind of interest. Just coming from me going from college to the NFL, they always showed a lot of interest in me, so that was big. And just, I mean, like you say, they scheme I played in college. So it was really getting back to kind of my roots of where I started, how I'm used to playing football. So that was real big for me, too.
Now, what you say is true, because when you were coming out of college, Philadelphia was very interested in you, but Pittsburgh drafted you. Now you remember the Eagles, and you join a defensive line with Fletcher Cox and Malik Jackson and more. As you've said, there are so many dogs on that line. When you think about your ability to beat guards one-on-one, and then you think about playing alongside the rest of the guys and all that talent, how excited do you get, and how do you feel about that fit for you?
I mean, it's very exciting just to be around so many great players. That's going to create a lot of one-on-ones for players like me. So I just look forward to that. I love getting one-on-ones and showing what I can do. So I just know in this game, it's just more, more of an attack game instead of, like, really reading and two-gapping. So that just really shows. That's just really kind of a great feeling for me going in. So I'm just eager to get out there with the guys and get to work.
Javon Hargrave, my guest. When you talk attack scheme, of course, you think about Jim Schwartz. You're playing in a Jim Schwartz defense. As a defensive lineman, what is it you like about his defense and the way he approaches the game?
It's more off of getting out the ball. Let your defensive lineman, create the line of scrimmage and make plays. It's just a real fun defense. It's like a lot of plays for defensive linemen out there. I guess you can see by the production that the whole defensive line has on the Eagles already and just by the players they have. So it's just exciting just to get back to something like that. I was mostly a nose guard at Pittsburgh. I love playing that too. I had to really adjust to that when I was coming into the league. So for me to get back to my roots, I call it my roots, and being able to play in a scheme like this is real. I'm really excited for it and ready to compete for it.
Javon Hargrave of the Eagles joining us. So when you think about your roots, like, you obviously have to be physically elite to be a great defensive lineman, but what does it take from a mental and psychological standpoint? Like, how much of that battle is physical and how much of it's mental?
Oh, it's really mental. Every game, every play ain't going to be your play. So you just got to kind of keep just living in the moment. I mean, it's a lot of plays probably last year, even though as many good plays as I had a lot of plays that was bad. And you just got to keep reminding yourself it's just to keep going, your play going to come. Man, you can be having a bad game for three quarters and make the biggest play of the game. So that's how it really is playing that defensive line. You get reached or cut off and somebody run through your hole. You can't let that sit in the back of your mind. You just got to keep going. And that's something that I just learned over the years, coming into my fifth year. Just every play is a different play, and every play is a play you can make a big play.
It seems to me the road to this spot's been really interesting in the sense that, like, when you were growing up, you fell in love with football at a very early age, like all the way back to grade school. What do you remember about the early days of football, and what was it about that game that you liked so much in the beginning?
Man, for me, I played a lot of positions. I played running back, tight end, linebacker. And even me, as a young kid, I was like so into playing running back and playing linebacker, just being like a skill guy, something like that. Because, you know, back in the day, that's who get all the credit when you're in the little leagues. But it was always something about playing defensive line or me just getting off the ball and getting to the quarterback. That was just came so natural to me. So I think it was like my ninth grade year when I really played. I played JV for the first game and I, you know, crushed it and played varsity after that. But it just came so natural, and that just really gave me a sense of I was born to play defensive lineman, and made me fall in love with football and just, you know, and just trying to see how good I can get at this game.
Javon Hargrave joining us. Now, in terms of skills, I mean, you were a skill guy. In fact, you were a huge basketball fan. Rumor has it you were also a pretty solid basketball player. How would you describe your basketball skills?
Oh, yeah, I was the man back in high school. But
right?
Like I say, I had too many bad games in basketball, so I knew it really wasn't made for me. I mean, I had a lot of good games, but basketball, you can get frustrated in basketball, and you can't really take it out on nobody. You still got to play. In football, you get frustrated. You can take it out on the offensive lineman or the quarterback. So that was kind of the difference with me. But basketball, that was really my favorite sport. That still is one of my favorite sports. That's my favorite sport just to watch and just look at. But, yeah, I kind of knew when I started seeing them seven-footers in high school that I had to kind of go the football way.
It's great. Like, when you went to South Carolina State, now, when you first got there, you were not necessarily in the kind of physical shape that you wanted to be in. So what were the first few workouts like?
Man, I got introduced to winter conditioning very soon. So I was passing out. I was just, you know, slacking, just falling down. Everybody just looking at me, laughing at me. But I sat out a whole semester coming out of high school. So I didn't do nothing. I didn't work out or anything. So when I got to South Carolina State, I was just so much out of shape and gained so much weight that I was just pitiful. So, I mean, after about a few weeks, I started to get my wind, and, you know, I started progressing from there. I just didn't quit and just kept going. And after a while, it was just normal. I just I got in a routine and got with the program.
Javon Hargrave joining us. The other thing was, too, like, those who know, like David Blanchard, who was the defensive line coach there, said, quote, a lot of people couldn't see it because, like I said, he wasn't in shape, but his first step was amazing, just getting off the ball. I know I couldn't believe it. I told the guys, I said, man, this guy is special. And he was actually laying on the ground getting water, and I was like, no, this guy is good, end of quote. So what did it mean to you to have him believing in you like that at that time, knowing how good you could be?
I mean, he always, you know, he always gave me confidence. He pushed me, even, you know, when nobody else really seen it, he always was telling me that I was going to be one of the best ones. He always told me I was competing with, you know, everybody else in the world, not just with the people in his room. So I just took that and ran with it. Like you say, he pushed me. He really did push me when I was in college. I mean, at the time, you wouldn't have known he was saying that because he was on me hard about
right.
pushing myself. So, I mean, he just, you know, he helped me take it to another step, man. Helped me start pushing myself and getting to where I was today.
All right, so you want to talk about taking it to another step. You had that now legendary game against Bethune-Cookman in October 2014. In that game, you tied the FCS record with 6 sacks. Jalen Simmons, who was on the team in South Carolina State, said, quote, to be there as it happened was just eye-opening. It was crazy, end quote. So what do you remember about that game, and how important was that in terms of putting you on the map?
I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was a big game for us. I think we just lost the week before. I didn't practice nothing that week because I had a knee injury. So I don't even think, I didn't even come in. That was my first game not starting in college since I've been in South Carolina State. So, you know, they was rotating me in, and I think I ended up getting 1 set, and I got 2. Then after that, I felt like I was just in the zone. I didn't even realize what I was doing until after the game. Like, I didn't even know I had 6 sacks until after the game when the reporter told me. So it was just crazy. It was just a great feeling just to hear that after the game, and just knowing as much work as I put in, it was all coming to fruition. And just I would just feel like that's the game that really put me on with the NFL. And in my college career. And it's just, I was talking to a friend the other day, just that game will always be spoke of around South Carolina State, and I'm just happy to be a part of it.
Now, it puts you on the map, but you just kept on the grind. NFL teams were keeping an eye on you, and then you get to draft night. The story goes that you and your family were at a bowling alley when you were drafted. They made the announcement over the PA system. Your dad said everybody was crying and running up to congratulate you. What do you remember about that night and that experience?
Oh, it was crazy. I was, you know, back and forth. Yeah, draft is just a long process. Like, you know, I'm sitting waiting for 2 or 3 rounds. It just felt like it's days of just waiting and hearing names called. So I think I was at the end of the 3rd round. So I was just, you know, hurt, just mad because I didn't think I was going to get drafted that day. I was just sitting there listening to my headphones, and then I get the 412 call. And I knew I seen a Pittsburgh number coming across the screen. So I just answered and heard Coach T, and my family just hitting me. They don't know what's going on. They at the inside the bowling alley. I'm outside right now. They at the door jumping and screaming and shouting. It was just it was just one of those feelings that you can never get back. Like, I never feel like I ever feel that feeling again, but it was just a so surreal moment just to see all my family so happy and everybody running and jumping on me. And just to hear Coach T tell me they was going to take me in the 3rd round. And it was crazy. I told everybody, I wish everybody could get that feeling because that's just one of the best. That was the best feeling I ever felt in my life.
That's a great story. Now, you also have one of the coolest nicknames in the NFL, the Grave Digger. How did you get that nickname, and how much does that define your attitude on the field?
Man, it was my defensive coordinator, Coach Adams. He just started calling me. First it was Graveyard, and then we got the screen ball, and I started, you know, tackling all the quarterbacks, and he started calling me Grave Digger. And from then, that's when everybody from the team started calling me that, and I put it on Instagram, and that's just been it for the whole world. I mean, it just took off from there. So it just came from South Carolina State, and it just kept it rolling in the NFL.
So let me finally ask you, at South Carolina State, you are a legend in the weight room. How are you going about staying in shape right now when you can't get into the facility?
Man, I got a Peloton bike right now. I just ordered a Peloton bike. I'll be on that 24/7. I do it 2 or 3 times a day, just trying to get my cardio. I'm doing push-ups. They got workouts on there I can do on the Peloton bike. So I'm really in my apartment just trying to and get it in the morning and get it in at night. But I'm just, you know, I'm just finding ways just to stay in shape and stay at it.
Jim, and I did not know the answer to that. That's not why I asked you that. But I've had my Peloton now for a few years, and I've been hitting mine hard, too, during this time. Which rides do you do? How long are the rides that you do? And what are some of the other exercises or classes you take?
I just did the 60-minute ride today, the 60-minute hip-hop just this morning. And I do the core after each workout. That's the only one I've really been doing is the 60-minute and the 45-minute one. I usually do the 45-minute one at night. But I'm waiting for my dumbbells to come. I'm going to start doing the leg workouts and the upper body workouts with it too pretty soon.
I love it, dude. I got to admit, I'll be real. I ride the bike, and I do some of the weight stuff on my own, but I haven't been doing as much of that with the bike. I got to start doing more of that with the bike. But I do the 45-minute rides, and they're awesome. Javon Hargrave joining us.
They're
good, right? They're tough, aren't they?
Yeah, they're tough.
How many calories do you burn during your ride?
The most that I had was 700, but usually around like 650. I try to get into 600, 700.
Dude, if you have a 7 in front of yours, you are working, man. You are working.
Oh, yeah. I'll be drinking.
I hear you. He is a 2-time All-American at South Carolina State, and one of the big signings earlier this month, Philadelphia got him to a 3-year deal, Javon Hargrave. Javon, really appreciate you. That was a fun conversation. Have a great time with that. I hope we can do it again soon.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you. That was great. It finally happened. The very best player on the 2019 Patriots finally spoke up and made some interesting non-cliche type comments about the organization's very unusual offseason. And yes, I'm talking about Stephon Gilmore, not Tom Brady. I'm talking about Gilmore and the respectful comments that he made to ESPN.com about Brady being with the team for so long that you could never see him leaving, but it is the NFL, and the NFL is a business, and I do agree with that. But if you thought that Gilmore was going to sound the panic alarm around Foxborough in search of Brady's heir apparent, then you are mistaken. In fact, if you believe the words that came out of his mouth, I would have thought for at least a second that TB43's replacement is already on the roster. And I'm sorry, Hoyer, the Destroyer fans. Gilmore was not talking about the organization's decision to bring back that vet. He wanted to talk about JS23. Jared Stidham instead. The NFL Defensive Player of the Year, Gilmore, said, quote, "He came in and worked hard and got better and better as the year went on. He has a strong arm." Gilmore went on, quote, "He makes some tough throws. Definitely made it hard on me in practice each and every week, going against whoever I was covering. Making some great throws, it allowed me to get better in practice to prepare for the games," end quote. Again, I'm not talking about some scrub or some practice squatter talking about running against Stidham. That's the 2019 NFL Defensive Player of the Year, arguably the best corner in all football, praising the fourth round rookie and saying that he made it hard on him in practice. And he wasn't the only one. That wasn't a one-off. Devin McCourty, also a stud from that secondary, also weighed in about Stidham on his double coverage podcast with his brother Jason. He said, quote, "To me, there were weeks he was just on point. And those were some of our best weeks as a defense, mainly because Stiddy ate us up in practice leading up to the game and I think put more pressure on us," end quote. Damn, Stiddy? Stiddy ate us up? Stiddy put pressure on us? Stiddy made for some of the best weeks we had as a defense? The best defense in the NFL? I don't know what I like best about that. Yes, I do. The nickname Stiddy. I mean, maybe Stiddy might be the new Cuddy. Minus the Marlboro Reds. Minus the flask. Minus the celebrity wife. Minus the hit reality show. Minus the memes. Minus everything. But I love it. And again, remember, this is not coming from a member of the Bengals defense. No offense, Cincy. It's coming from a three-time Super Bowl champ on the NFL's best defense and coming from the NFL Defensive Player of the Year. And yes, I do understand that what a guy does in practice and games are two very different things, but we're still talking about two really well-respected dudes throwing some nice praise towards Stiddy. And they aren't exactly freaking the hell out like a lot of the Chowd Nation over the loss of Tom Brady. Now, again, I'm on record as saying the hood should have kept Brady. The hood should have done more to keep Brady. They should have come together. They should have worked their differences out. You work your differences out, you add a few pieces, and you try to get that seventh Lombardi together. It could have happened. It should have happened, but it didn't. And now both parties are moving on. Now, that said, and I'm on record as saying that. I'm not coming off that, I don't think. Because on some level, it's so much more interesting that they didn't come together, right? They should have, but they didn't. And I'm glad they didn't. Because instead of having one boring story that we've seen a million times, we now have these two amazing stories. TB43 looking to rebuild and resurrect himself in Tampa and prove to the hood and himself that he can still play at a high level and that the Pats made a big mistake without him, moving on without him. The hood, on the other hand, great second story, trying to prove that the Patriot way is still the right way and that no one player is bigger than the team, that no one player is any different than any of the other 52 on the roster, including Brady. Of course they should have come together. And of course they could have come together, but it's so much better that they didn't. Better for all of us. So instead of a non-story, we have two great stories right now. and the Pats are imminently more interesting than they would have been if Brady did come back. And also, quote, on Stiddy, I really like what I hear about Stiddy. And it's not just from Gilmore or McCourty. It's that and pretty much anybody who's ever been around this guy and worked with this guy. They all rave. But it's kind of odd though, right? Kind of odd that the Pats aren't trying to bring in a big game quarterback or a big name quarterback. I mean, this free agency quarterback class is one for the ages. I mean, it's almost legendary. And unless they're waiting for the market to bottom out, it would appear the hood has got no interest in any of these available vets. And think about who's out there. Jameis Winston is only 26, and he led the NFL in passing yardage. You don't see New England knocking down his door. Without the benefit of a physical, we don't know exactly sure what Cam Newton is dealing with physically right now, but damn, he looks healthy. He looks great. And wasn't it Hood who was so hot on him in the past? Not hot on his trail right now, though. You know, like, read into this what you may. Maybe the Hood is playing poker. Maybe the Hood has serious questions about all these guys who are available. Maybe the Hood is trying to make his salary cap right. Or maybe the Hood believes in what he has right now. Maybe he really, really sees something in the fourth rounder. And what do we know about Stiddy? He's got a gun. We know he can push downfield. And apparently he's got the makeup and the work ethic to match. Put it this way. I don't know if Stiddy is the next big thing, but it looks more and more like he's going to get that next big shot. And I can't wait to see what the young dude has. Just like I can't wait to see what the old man, TB43, has in Tampa. I don't know what I'm saying is, Pats fans, maybe that old mumbler is onto something. See, Jim Rome, I told you about Stiddy. Who needs an old guy when you got a 23-year-old stud? This ain't my first rodeo, radio man. Hey, rodeo man, radio man. This ain't my first rodeo. Like, I've been saying that Belichick did the wrong thing in letting Brady get away and that he should have kept him, could have kept him, should have kept him. Now I think I might want to rethink that. He is Greg Berhalter. Greg, it is so good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, Jim. How you doing? How's good. Everyone holding up?
Good. I was going to ask you the same thing. I mean, it's such really good. Thanks for asking. It's such a busy month for you. And, of course, the plan had been to face the Netherlands. Then you were scheduled to be facing Wales today in Cardiff. Obviously, the matches have been called off because of COVID-19. So before we talk about the team, what is life like for you and the family right now?
So we're bunkered down in Chicago. Everyone's doing well. It's really nice to be able to spend time with the whole family in this, you know, concentrated amount of time where we're all just together. The kids are doing their schoolwork. Sebastian's home. I'm training with Sebastian, so that's been fun. But you know, we're trying to turn it into a positive and spend a lot of quality family time together.
I think that's exactly the approach. I'm going to ask you about the family in just 1 minute. Now, the decision was made to call off the two friendlies, Greg, in Europe. Obviously, that's a decision that had to be made. But just how much does that impact your plans for the spring and then into summer in preparation for facing Honduras?
So, you know, I think that, you know, we're putting those games off made total sense, first of all. I think it was the right thing to do, and especially to call them off that early so we could plan and everything like that. Now with all the leagues postponed, you know, we're going to be on the tail end of things resuming. So we'll first start the leagues up again, and then we'll have to adjust our schedule based on that. And right now it's TBD. No one really knows when it's going to be starting up again, and no one knows when the national team programs will be put back into playing.
We're talking to Greg Berhalter. Now, you and I have talked so much in the past about the challenges that come with being a national team head coach, because anytime you get with the team together all in one place is so valuable. So how are you approaching this time right now?
So first of all, we reached out to all the players and wanted to get a good understanding of their personal situations. You know, there's a lot of, players in all different countries and just trying to get a hold of what they're up to and to let them know that we're supporting them from afar. And then we maintain communication with them. We started some communication channels where we can all chat and get, stay in touch with each other. And then with the staff, we've been working on projects. I think now is a good time to, you know, to do things that you don't normally work on, take a look at some detail of parts of the game and really break it down really thoroughly. So we've been doing that as a staff. We've been having conference calls twice a week with Zoom meeting, and that's been really productive. And the staff's been great, and it's it has given us time to work on some things.
Greg Berhalter, my guest. You know, great for you, great for the staff. And then the guys, they have to do what they have to do. I've talked to every athlete who's come on, Greg, and I pretty much asked them, how are you staying in shape? How is this impacting your training when you are limited and restricted? What about your guys? How are they getting their work in?
You know, every club handles it differently. So we've heard examples where clubs immediately drop off bikes for the guys, drop off weights for them. We've seen some guys doing Zoom meeting with weight sessions so they stay connected with each other. You know, a lot of individual work. Some of the German teams now are working in small groups where they can train with three guys at a time, doing it that way. So, you know, it's really interesting to see how clubs are handling it and the different approaches. We've seen one team that has teams eating meals together on Zoom meetings just to keep that connectivity. So it's been fun to watch that process and really see how each and every team is taking advantage of this time.
That's really interesting. I've not heard that before. Greg Berhalter is joining us. Now, when you take a step back and you look at your first 16 months or so with the national team as head coach, how would you describe where the team is at the very moment?
You know, we've made a ton of progress from December 2018 and most importantly, getting younger guys experience. You know, we've played with extremely young group this last year and a half and getting these guys international experience, you know, letting them experience what it's like to play away games, what it's like to play in knockout games, what it's like to play in tournament finals. So that this year has been great. And when I think about, potentially the World Cup qualifying starting this fall, that experience is going to be really important because when you go down into some of these countries and you're playing in really hostile environments, the players need to be prepared.
That's something you talk a lot about, Greg, especially with the young guys, that you want to talk to them about their mindset. You want to talk about them cultivating fearlessness that shows up on the field. Is it something that you can teach and coach, or is it something they naturally have? How do you approach enhancing that, developing that?
You know, you can definitely improve those skill sets. And the first part of it is getting that experience playing in games like that, you know, making that part of your memory bank. But then it's also talking to the players about it, subjecting them to training sessions that they're under, a lot of duress, making them push through, giving them the mindset that they can only control so much, right, and really focus on what they can control and leave the rest out of it. So we're thinking of ways all the time to really put the players under pressure and have them experience that to be able to deal with it.
Talking to Greg Berhalter, he is the head coach of the U.S. men's national team. You know, you and I have talked in the past also about the sense. You're a huge sports fan, but growing up in New Jersey, you obviously took to the game. When you first started playing soccer, and I preface this by saying you're not looking to make it about you, but I will for a minute. When you first started to play, what was it about the game that appealed to you the most?
I think it was the diversity of it. Growing up in New Jersey and playing with all different ethnicities and seeing how the game was played on different parts of the world and coming in contact with so many unique people because of the game of soccer, that's what really attracted me to it. I really, Northern New Jersey was a lot of Italians, a lot of South Americans, and being in that melting pot, I think really piqued my curiosity about the game.
And then you played your high school soccer at St. Benedict's Prep, and you were playing with Claudio Reyna. What were those days like?
We had a good team. We had a good team. We, my junior and senior year, we didn't lose a game. We lost two games my sophomore year, but we were good. And I think, part of it was, the experience that we got in high school soccer. We traveled all around the nation playing top level competitions, and that was way back in the late 80s, early 90s, and so it wasn't really being done that much, and we got a great experience playing, and it was fun to be winning like we did.
Greg Berhalter is my guest. Now, you mentioned your son Sebastian at the very top, so you fast forward and now you're the U.S. national team coach. Sebastian is now home, but he's a homegrown player with Columbus. Purely on a personal level, what is that like for you?
It's great. You know, I think it's taking, you know, the coaching hat off and just being a parent. You know, you're proud to see someone work so hard, you know, in a sport his whole life and then become a professional. It's really, you know, it's a special feeling. It's a good example, you know, for other kids to know that you put a lot of hard work in and you stay focused and you stay disciplined and you can, you know, you can start achieving some of your dreams. So it's great to see him become a pro.
Hey, Greg, isn't that wild like that? And congratulations to you and he. That's an amazing, amazing thing. And then I think about our mutual friend, Craig Johnson, and his son, Ryan Johnson, being a first-round pick in the NHL. You know, the fact that we're all hanging out in Irvine, like Jake Rome is not going to be in the NFL or MLB, but how about the Johnsons? What an amazing story that is, too.
It's a hotbed of Turtle Rock is a hotbed of professional athletes,
right? That's it, right? Turtle Rock is, man. It's a factory.
That's a factory.
You know, and then you got Claudio's son, Gio, who's making a name for himself at 17 in Germany.
Yep.
Last month, you said the plan was to call him up to the national team for the friendlies this month. What did you see in him that let you know that he's ready for such a big step?
You know, so that's another part of the process is, you know, subjecting these guys to higher levels, to international level, you know, when they're starting to get success. You know, he's starting to play for Dortmund. Dortmund's a very high-level club. The next step for him is going to be playing regularly for Dortmund and then also playing regularly for the men's national team. And you have to get him started sometime. And we thought it was a great time to, you know, to get him integrated into the team, let him play some games in Europe, some friendly games. And we thought the time it was right.
Greg Berhalter joins me for another moment. The thing is, though, right, I mean, it is, you want to get him going, you want to get him started, and national team fans get really hyped when it comes to young players, and then there's this rush to declare someone as the next big thing. As somebody who has lived this, both as a player and as a coach, how challenging is it to go from dominating against players who are the same age to competing against grown men who have been professionals, who've been at it for a number of years?
It's a huge difference. And, you know, what I tell the players is just one day at a time, right? Everyone wants, you know, people to develop, you know, really quickly. But it's just about the consistency in the effort and working, using every day as an opportunity to get better, using every day as an opportunity to improve on your game. And, you know, that's part of being a pro. You have to bring it every single day. And, you know, for these young guys, it's great. You know, a guy like Gio, it's amazing that he's played in the Champions League already at this age. And now it's about doing it again and again and again.
Greg, last thought. Is there a message in this? And I think so, because you touched on it, that, like, what we're dealing with right now is really scary, very disconcerting, very trying. This is not in any way a good thing, but can you turn it into a positive? Can you somehow use this as an opportunity to get better? And can it be for not just athletes or your players, but for all of us?
I think you can. I think that, you know, what this is forcing us all to do is work together, is use teamwork, you know, the whole nation. We've been given directives that we need to follow, and it's only going to be successful if we follow them. So the first thing is working together. And the second thing is appreciating what we really have. I think sometimes we take it for granted. And this gives us the opportunity to kind of refocus and really appreciate, you know, our environment, our community, and really appreciate being part of it.
Extremely well said. He is the U.S. men's national team head coach. He was named head coach in December of 2018 and the first U.S. men's national team head coach to have played for the U.S. in a World Cup. Good friend of the program, Greg Berhalter. Greg, so good to get caught up. Glad that you and the family are doing well. All of our best, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you. You too. Always good talking to you.
Good night now!